and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the plume of toxic pollution that has turned the Animas River a mustard yellow as the toxins make their way downstream from the mining town of Silverton, Colorado, into New Mexico. We will first speak with Gene Bassett, a senior associate for Environment Colorado, to get an understanding of how much pollution is contained in the 23,000 abandoned mines in Colorado that continually leak toxins in what is known as acid mine drainage. Then we'll get an assessment of the damage done downstream to the fish and wildlife from Ty Churchwell, a backcountry coordinator with the environmental group Trout Unlimited. He joins us to discuss how the River of Lost Souls, as it is known in Spanish, was brought back to life after being polluted by mining activity, but is now threatened again. Then we'll examine the just-released Reuters-Ipsos poll following Thursday's Republican presidential primary debate that has Donald Trump with a commanding lead of 24%, with Jeb Bush trailing in second with 12%, down from 17% before the debate. A leading voice on white identity and race in modern America, Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class, joins us. We'll discuss how Trump, in spite of efforts by Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch to ambush him in the Fox News debate, has taken dog whistle politics to a new level and is being rewarded by Republican primary voters as the punditry tries to write him off. Then finally, we will look into the restart of the Sendai nuclear plant in Japan, the first to go back online since the Fukushima disasters in March of 2011. David Lochbaum, one of the nation's top independent experts on nuclear power, who worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and is now the director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists, joins us to discuss why, after getting by without nuclear energy for the last 4 years, Japan is bringing back nuclear power. And joining us now is Gene Bassett, a senior associate for Environment Colorado, where she is responsible for coordinating policy development, research, and legislative advocacy. She previously served as the political organizer for the Public Interest Network and was the executive director of Environment New Mexico. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gene Bassett.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And the EPA, who apparently, and some people in your neighborhood are calling it the Environmental Pollution Agency because of this accident that spilled 3 million gallons of mining waste into the Animas River. And now originally they said there was 1 million gallons. They've had to triple that size. Now, I take it that this is all waste that comes from mines. In this case, I believe the mine was closed in 1923. But in that area around Silverton, Colorado, well, Colorado itself has about 23,000 abandoned mines, I understand.
That's correct.
So, and this is a long-standing problem, right? These old abandoned mines have been leaching toxins for, what, maybe 100 or 200 years?
Yeah, exactly.
So because you're up there in the mountains at Silverton, and of course the snow melts and the water drains into these abandoned mines, mm-hmm. and it creates what's called, I believe, acid mine drainage, right? So there's toxins in there as a result in these mines as a result of the mining that goes back hundreds of years. Is that
right?
So my understanding, though, is that the EPA tried to basically take on this problem starting in the 1980s, and they wanted to declare part of the Silverton region a Superfund site, which
Correct.
Would, of course, allow for the influx of huge federal funds to make a real cleanup effort. But apparently local residents resisted this move out of concern that the bad publicity would drive away tourists. Is that what happened?
Yes, and it's been an ongoing debate for a long time because, as you point out, I mean, if it's designated a Superfund site, then you get the federal resources you need to do the cleaning because it's a significant task, and there's obviously with a number of these mines, and not really understanding the degree of the contaminants because of the seepage that slowly occurred. There's the seepage, but there's also the extraction of the water sitting in these minerals and what it's, you know, then extracting from them, and then that's what's ending up in the water. So what we've seen is this back and forth between, okay, let's designate a Superfund site and get it cleaned up, and then push back saying, well, no, if it's designated a Superfund site, we might decrease you know, our tourism industry, which is the largest after now that the mines are all shut. That's, you know, one of the largest sources of income for these communities. And there's no evidence. There's other communities around the country that have Superfund sites and still have tourism. So, but the point is that, yes, it's you have pushback from the local residents about that designation.
So, and now the local residents are being really adversely affected, right? The rafting and river touring, right. Tourists to come there for river rafting, etc. There's no way in the world that you can justify this mustard-colored water, right?
Right.
So it's having a disastrous impact, I take it.
It is, and that's why the EPA has announced it as a national disaster, so that there would be the financial resources available to, because, yes, so these, whether it's the outdoor rafting companies, fishing, you know, these are all having a terrible impact financially on these different, you know, outreach. And really, when we look at the long-term impact, it's really still unknown, because as the plume moves downstream, what you have is the sediment settles onto the river bottom, and it's rocks. And so we don't know, you know, obviously there's aquatic bugs and other wildlife, but that sediment is likely to get kicked up during high water flows. So, and what they're also seeing down there, that is in some of the domestic wells near the river, they're seeing this, you know, yellow tint in the days since the spill. So it's not, you know, and what's not clear is what are all the contaminants that have gotten into that water.
Hi, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. You know, this is a critical issue, and I think it's a real wake-up call, and I think, you know, it's time that we deal with these mines, and this has been clearer than ever what happened last week.
And again, I've been speaking with Jean Bassett, who's a Senior Associate for Environment Colorado, where she is responsible for coordinating policy development, research, and legislative advocacy. She previously served as the political organizer for the Public Interest Network and was the Executive Director of Environment New Mexico. And joining us now is Ty Churchwell, who's a backcountry coordinator based in Durango, Colorado, on the staff of Trout Unlimited. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ty Churchwell.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And tell us about Trout Unlimited.
Trout Unlimited is America's largest and oldest nonprofit river conservation organization. We have roughly 150,000 members all over the country and around 25 staff operating, again, all around the country.
And the river that you're on now, right, is being polluted, I believe, by this this spill of toxic waste from mines, in this case, a mine that was closed down in 1923.
Yeah, correct. The Animas River has its headwaters above Silverton, Colorado, and about 45 miles downriver flows through downtown Durango, Colorado.
And that's where you are, right? And where an emergency has been declared, I understand, because the drinking water is polluted.
That's not entirely correct. Durango's drinking water comes from a different river. We do supplement high demand in summer with some Animas water, but the vast majority of our drinking water comes from the Florida. So at present, our drinking water supply is not affected.
But my understanding is that Durango and La Plata County in Colorado have declared states of emergencies. That's not about drinking water. That must be about something else.
Yeah, that's correct. I don't know the exact details on what criteria was used to request that declaration of an emergency. As I understand it, it does bring an immediate amount of relief money to bear here locally at the state level. To help assist with some of the immediate issues of citizens. Example might be some of our ranchers and homes with well water are needing to water truck to them, and I believe that some of this relief money could be employed or is being employed to for those types of purposes.
So, in terms of the work that you do with Trout Unlimited, it seems to me that for the longest time, fish have been kind of like the canaries in the coal mine in those rivers, because for going back a couple of hundred years, since these mines go back that far, there has been toxins leaching into the water, and that this has been an ongoing problem. And going back a couple of hundred years ago, they simply just dumped everything in the rivers to begin with, and the fish died out. But starting in the 1930s, that practice was stopped, and there's been an effort, an ongoing effort to clean up the rivers, and presumably they've brought back fish, and they've been in a very relatively healthy state until this abandoned mine, the Gold King mine, which was closed in 1923, the dam that was holding this massive amount of water laced with arsenic, lead, and other toxins was breached accidentally by the EPA.
Yeah, to your first point, yes, trout are the canary in the coal mine. They are an indicator species, along with the insects that they feed on the overall general river and watershed health. So on that point, you're correct. I want to be clear that the Gold King mine above Silverton, which prompted this disaster, is not an abandoned mine. We actually have a property and a mine owner who currently owns the property, so it is not considered an abandoned mine.
Just pick up that again. You dropped out. It's not considered an abandoned mine.
It is not an abandoned mine. There is a current owner, property owner and miner who owns that property, so it is not an abandoned mine. Right. The Gold King is not an abandoned mine.
I see. But the Red and Bonita mines, which are nearby, that they were trying to drain the heavy metals from those rivers. That's when that was the original intent of the EPA, I believe.
Yeah, they're working with the property owner at the Red and Bonita to do some bulkheading, and as I understand it, we're exploring one of the close proximity mines to the Red and Bonita to help develop a plan for further remediation. Also, as I understand it, I believe you referred to a dam of some sort that had been breached, and I'm not sure that's how I would characterize it. Again, from my understanding, there was some rocks and wood and other debris inside the mine that had caused a plug and backed up water, but it was not a dam, as you refer to it, or any sort of official concrete bulkhead.
And that's the heart of the problem with these hundreds of abandoned mines in Colorado. I believe there's 23,000 in total. That there's natural drainage from melting snow, etc., that goes through these mines, and they get filled up, and then you have this phenomenon of acid mine drainage, right? You've just explained that it wasn't so much a dam, it was just plugged up. But by removing the plug, suddenly all this stuff gushes out.
Yeah, that's correct. And you've got some fairly accurate numbers in terms of abandoned and draining mines in Colorado, though there are no exact numbers. We know that there are roughly 500,000 abandoned mines in the western United States. In Colorado, I don't know exactly what that number is, but in the Upper Animas, as an example, I believe that there are better than 30 abandoned mines in the Upper Animas Basin.
And the Animas, translated from Spanish, means River of Souls. Is that right?
Yeah, the full name of the Animas is El Rio de las Animas Perdidas, which means the River of Lost Souls.
Wow, what an irony. In terms of, at least in terms of lost fish, and I don't know. Just in closing, I don't want to keep you. I know you're being besieged by calls today, Ty Churchill. What's your prognosis about? I mean, I know we don't know. The estimates were low, a million gallons. Now it's been tripled now to 3 million of this toxic stuff that's turned this river into a kind of mustard yellow. What's your sense of the damage done, and what possible remediation could be employed?
Well, that's an excellent question, and to be quite clear, here on Monday afternoon, now I believe 6 days since the original incident occurred, the plume has moved through Durango and did several days ago. We are seeing some clearing in the color of the river. But that's good news, certainly. Trout Unlimited is deeply concerned about the health of the Animas and its world-class trout fishery, which is the foundation of Durango's vitally important outdoor recreation economy. Anglers come from all over the world and to this region of Colorado to fish the gold medal waters of the Animas. So our primary concern is, will the trout survive? We do have some good initial results in that there was not a mass die-off of trout as that plume came through several days ago. Parks and Wildlife has installed some cages in the river with over 100 trout to be used, as you mentioned earlier, as the canaries in the coal mine. As of late last night, only one of those fish had died. And also we're looking at the macroinvertebrates in the river, and those, of course, would be the insects that the trout feed on. Same thing, we're not seeing any mass die-off of the insects at this time, but that doesn't mean we're in the clear. Acute toxicity is one issue, and we may have gotten past that with some success, but I think everyone is quite concerned on what the long-term chronic exposure to these metals might be for the aquatic insects and the trout.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ty Churchwell.
You're very welcome, Ian. Thanks for calling.
And again, I've been speaking with Ty Churchwell, who's a backcountry coordinator based in Durango, Colorado, on the staff of Trout Unlimited. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest poll that has Donald Trump with a commanding lead in spite of the pundits writing him off after the first Republican debate.
Don't you think it's sad what's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. Poison floating out to sea now threatens life on.
Conspiracy-minded protesters of corporate greed. We who have nothing and most likely will till we all end up locked up in jails by conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American males. Diamonds and dogs.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his path-breaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. A former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Thank you. I'm so glad to join you.
And following the debate, the first Republican presidential primary debate last Thursday on Fox News, the punditry had basically started to write off Donald Trump. But now a poll just came out on today, Monday, a Reuters Ipsos poll that finds Donald Trump leading the GOP 17-strong field of 2016 presidential candidates at 24%, and the nearest, his closest rival is former Governor Jeb Bush, who trails him at 12%, and Jeb Bush is down from 17% before the debate. So, you know, Trump, according to this poll, he won the debate, and Bush lost ground. I mean, what an extraordinary turn of events.
I would say a deliciously extraordinary turn of events. Listen, this is dog whistle politics. Trump is beating the Republicans at their own game. For 50 years, Republicans have been hiding their sort of economic royalist politics behind a sort of a populist effort to trump up fear and anxiety in the electorate. And now here comes Donald Trump, and he says, well, if you want fear and anxiety in the electorate, let me show you how that's done. So he goes after undocumented immigrants as illegals, as rapists, as murderers. He goes after the Republican Party itself as in the pockets of big corporations, which it is. He goes after women. And then when they say that's beyond the pale, he says, you know, what's dragging America down is political correctness, which is a great slam against all sorts of groups. Trump is playing the Republican game, which is stir up fear about loss of social position, stir up anxiety, stir up resentment towards marginal groups, and use that to drive people to the polls, historically, to vote for a bunch of politicians who are giving control of the marketplace and government over to the very rich. But now Trump is doing it just to satisfy his own ego. That's the difference.
Well, what I find extraordinary about this, though, Ian Haney-Lopez, is that it was so clear from that debate that Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch had set up the debate with their Fox correspondents basically to not so much ambush Trump, but to try and kill him off. They started the entire debate out with that first question meant to discredit him, which was, you know, would you, if you didn't get the nomination, would any of the candidates on the stage run as a third party candidate? And of course, the only person who put their hand up was Donald Trump. That was no accident.
No, I don't think that was an accident at all. But really, if the GOP leaders and if their big corporate backers are to kill off Trump, it's not going to be in terms of media representations of him, although they'll try. At the end of the day, the real threat to Trump is whether anybody else will back him financially or whether he's going to have to foot his own bill. And now he claims, the resources to go ahead and fund a third-party candidacy. We'll see if he's actually interested in spending a big chunk of his capital that way. But I think that's the way that the conservatives will ultimately shut him down. If he doesn't have anybody else coming in and putting tens of millions of dollars, even hundreds of millions of dollars behind his candidacy, Trump is going to go away. But not, one would hope, before he does a lot of damage in the sense of reviewing the sort of inanities that pass for policy and populism on the Republican side.
Well, it does strike me, though, as an irony that the very news network, if you can call Fox News a news network, that built up the Tea Party, this is the culmination of Tea Party politics, was that Thursday night debate.
I mean, quite right.
And now they're trying to kill off the Tea Party's vanguard, Donald Trump.
You have to wonder, though, whether they might not be a little bit ambivalent, whether Roger Ailes isn't saying to himself, do I kill off Trump or do I continue to use Trump to drive ratings? And I think it points to this this idea that Fox News has figured out a way to capitalize on ratings and on conservatism and driving conservative votes at the same time. But now they're facing a divergence. I mean, Trump is a ratings bonanza for Fox. Do they really want to kill him off? And that will show, is this really sort of entertainment? Or are they going to choose to follow their sort of political loyalties and do what they need to do to try and stop the hemorrhaging of the Republican Party?
Well, he actually did, I mean, obviously, some of the stuff that he said has been so outrageous and so unforgivable in any kind of moral universe. But nevertheless, when he was asked, I think, about Hillary Clinton giving her money, and again, that was another kind of ambush question, he said, look, I give money to everybody. I gave money to all you people on the stage, and that's how politics work. You give politicians money, and when you need it, you call them up, and they're right there snapping to attention, and they'll do exactly what you want. And he really did tell the American people, those listening, and I believe there were record numbers in terms of the ratings for that show, he told the truth about how our money-driven political system works. Do you think, not that that's particularly news to you or I or many of our listeners, but do you think it may have resonated a little?
I think it resonated with people in this perverse way. The people I've heard who are enthusiastic about Donald Trump say something like, we need somebody who's a businessman who's already rich so he can't be bought. And okay, so the logic is half there, which is a lot of our politicians are being bought by corporate backers and by rich dynasties. That's half right. The other part is the questionable part. Do you want somebody who's already rich and who's already deeply ensconced in the interests of the 0.1%, because they can't now be bought by the other 0.1%. That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, I think that, but there's that kernel of truth. We are witnessing, we are living in the midst of a political system in which our politicians are grossly indebted to the wealthiest corporations and individuals, and that badly skews who our politicians listen to.
Well, I thought that, you know, with the, by calling them out, he sort of exposed the kind of hollow and fatuous nature of these candidates. I mean, what was interesting to me was that the one candidate that nobody really paid any attention to in the press ended up, I think, being in many ways the most appealing, if not the most articulate and interesting, and that was Governor Kasich of Ohio. And the rest of them, I thought, I mean, the fact that they never repudiated his racist remarks about Mexicans from the beginning, and they basically never repudiated anything he said, and it took him to, you know, insult a Fox News anchor, a woman, before suddenly the Republicans became the party of sensitivity towards women.
here's what's interesting about that to me. Trump dog whistled women, and what I mean by that is he did the sort of classic dog whistle choreography. So the first part about that is you insinuate something, and you know, so he said, well, she's bleeding from the eye, she's bleeding from wherever. And the second part of that is when you're attacked, you turn around and say, hey, I never said what you're claiming I said, right? So when he was attacked for insinuating that she had been menstruating, he immediately turned around and said, you must be, only degenerates would think about that, right? So that was his defense. Now, that's what Republicans do around gender. That's what they do around race. That's what they do around sexual orientation all the time. They'll insinuate something about Trump himself, about illegals or about gay marriage. And then turn around and say, hey, you know, I don't know where you're reading the racism, the sexism from. I didn't say it. So why were Republicans so quick, even Fox News, so quick to say, hey, that comment about bleeding from everywhere, I don't know where, that was really about menstruation. Why were they so quick to pierce his language? I think they made the decision strategically that in order to destroy Trump, they need to really cast him as being so far beyond the pale, being so outrageous, of doing something that none of them would do. But in the end, he's using the sort of veiled language that all of them use. You know, you get Paul Ryan talking about a tailspin of culture in our inner cities. That's exactly that sort of language. Where were the Republicans then saying, hey, you know, he's insulting the culture of Black Americans, and that's outrageous. This is their game, to push this sort of poison into the conversation, to rile up people who are worried about the place of women in society, worried about the place of minorities in society, worried about homosexuals, and then to turn around and say, well, I didn't use an epithet, so I'm innocent. But here they're not allowing Trump to get away with it. I think because they've made the decision that they need to try and destroy him as quickly as possible. Now, what's interesting is that the poll suggests he's not working.
Well, it's not working, and the person who's come down in the polls is Governor Jeb Bush, who was previously at 17% and now it's at 12%, according to this Ipsos Reuters poll just out today. And most of the others in the field are pretty much obscure. Obviously, the person who did the most poorly, I think, was Senator Rand Paul. He seems to have sort of dropped into oblivion. And Ted Cruz is clearly waiting around on the fringes. If and when they destroy Trump, I guess he's going to pick up Trump's supporters. But again, just touching on Governor Kasich, who came across as being quite reasonable, some of the punditry following the debate said, you know, a dream ticket for the Republicans would be Kasich and Marco Rubio running as the vice president. And by the way, no matter what, I think Marco Rubio is running for vice president. So, I mean, I think he's a kind of a shoo-in in that regard. But the theory being that those are the two big important states, Florida and Ohio. But what I find extraordinary, Ian Haney-Lopez, is that all of this punditry and speculation notwithstanding, that ticket just is never going to make it, is it?
Paul Krugman wrote an article recently that I think was half right, in which he said, look, you know, the media is schizophrenic because the media is willing to call out Trump for his terminal silliness. But at the same time, the pundocracy takes seriously these other candidates, these other Republican candidates like Paul Ryan, like Jeb Bush, when they're all being silly. And I think that that's the part that's half right. There's silliness all around in terms of Republican candidates. Except that I think that Krugman stopped short because he didn't explain to us why there's so much silliness on the part of the Republican candidates, why they're all committed to these positions that are not credible, that seem transparent, that seem, you know, facetious at best. And the why is because they can't come out and say what they're really going to do. They can't come out and say, hey, we actually represent the interests of the very wealthiest in society. We really don't care that much about working Americans. And we really think that the solution is to give more power and more wealth to the already rich and powerful. They can't come close to saying that. So instead, they have trained a generation of Republican voters to respond to these dog whistles about the threat from minorities, the threat from women, the threat from gays, the threat from Muslims. That's what Republican voters now expect. And so if you have somebody who, let's say, wants to present himself as a more moderate Republican, a more reasonable Republican, the problem they run into is that's not the Republican base anymore. They can't listen to sort of moderate policy proposals or nuanced policy prescriptions. They have grown used to and now clamor for red meat kind of race baiting, red meat kind of culture war politics. And so this is not just Kasich running into this. This is Jeb Bush himself. And Jeb Bush is coming forward and saying, I can win this by being bipartisan. I'm going to tone down some of the ugliness. Even as he's going to promise in a ridiculous way to double the economic growth rate of the country without explaining how. But he wants to come across as moderate and reasonable. That's not what the base wants. And so it's going to be very hard to sort of gin up support for a sort of a moderate, nuanced Republican candidate. I don't see that happening.
So that means, you know, good news for Hillary Clinton, assuming she is the ultimate Democratic candidate, right? Because wouldn't a Kasich-Rubio ticket be the most threatening one she could face?
You know, I don't. So if they could get there, I don't know that Kasich and Rubio can do it. Can get there through the primaries. Mm. So all of this is good news for Hillary Clinton in the sense that we're saying, wow. You know, the Republicans have been telling us for the last couple of years that they're going to field this dream team and that it's going to show the depth of the Republican field. And it turns out that, you know, Trump is sort of turning this into a clown circus. That's obviously good news for any Democratic candidate. But we shouldn't turn that around and say, well, that means Clinton's going to be a shoo-in. She has got her own issues, and I think that some of them are highlighted and by what's going on in the Republican field. I mean, I think that there's the sense in which she can't be trusted, that she doesn't have the interests of working Americans at heart, that she holds herself above the law, that she's duplicitous around, for example, her email. I mean, a lot of those issues that seem to attach to Republicans, are also going to attach and be attached by the GOP as a strategy to Hillary Clinton herself. So I think we could be looking at an election in 2016 in which the electorate is badly splintered, that there's high passions on different sides, but that a lot of people are deeply alienated from the political process. So this is good for the Democrats in general, but I don't think that means 2016 is going to be a cakewalk, not by a long shot.
Well, I think a lot of people have made the pretty obvious connection that Bernie Sanders on the political left in this country is picking up enormous amount of steam. And he has had the biggest crowds of any candidate, hands down. And he'll be at the Los Angeles Sports Arena tonight in Los Angeles, which is a huge venue. And he is tapping into an obvious, a very deep well of discontent. And people are finding him very refreshing on the right, and particularly on the Tea Party right. It's the same, clearly, with Trump, isn't it? I mean, he's tapping into a well of discontent, even if it's a rather poisoned well.
Yeah, in some ways it's the same, because what Tea Party right is responding to is the perceived authenticity of Trump, you know, when he says, I'm not going to be politically correct. But actually, I think it's really quite different in the sense that Trump is an entertainer, and his display of authenticity is completely manufactured and completely artificial. This is Trump, the reality TV show, you know, who's just as real as reality TV. Whereas I think with Bernie Sanders, there's two things happening. One is the truthfulness of Sanders himself. These are his positions. He's been advocating these positions for 30 years. He's plain spoken. Nobody doubts that this is what he really believes. He's a candidate that is not poll testing and field testing everything he says before he says it. This is who he really is. That's one. Here's the other. Sanders is one of the few politicians, I think about Elizabeth Warren, sometimes Joe Biden, but one of the few politicians who's really coming out and reminding Americans of simple truths that we used to take for granted. You know, I mean, really simple truths, like government should work for everyone. The marketplace is not an end in itself, but ought to make everybody's lives better. We ought to have a fair and inclusive society. I mean, these are simple truths. Our politicians in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, they walked away from those truths over the last 40, 50 years, and Sanders didn't. And I think that his willingness to say, hey, we're all in this together. We need to take care of each other. We need to rein in good corporations and redistribute income. His willingness to say these basic truths, I think that's a large part of what's generating so much support for him. People, they like his honesty, but they also like these simple truths. We need a fair and inclusive society in which everybody has an equal chance at a dignified life. Wow. That's not much. In some ways, that is just basic and fundamental to any decent society. And yet, our politicians have stopped saying it. And with Sanders out there saying it, I think people are really, they're hungry for that message and they're rallying to him.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ian Haney-Lopez.
And thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, who's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. A former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the restart of a nuclear power plant in Japan, the first to go back online since the Fukushima disasters in March of 2011.
You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game.
Did you feel that rumble? Did you hear that sound? Well, it wasn't no earthquake, but it shook the ground. Maybe think about power, like it or not. Gotta work for Earth for what it's worth, 'cause this is the only Earth we got. Shut 'em down. That's the only way to keep 'em down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Lochbaum, who is one of the nation's top independent experts on nuclear power. He formerly worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and now serves as director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Lochbaum.
Thank you, Ian, for having me on.
And today in Japan, the Sendai nuclear plant, which has two 30-year-old reactors, it's been started up, and there's been a moratorium on nuclear power. They've all been shut down, I believe, in Japan since the Fukushima disaster of March of 2011. So I guess right off the top, we know this is being touted as a victory for Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who insists that without nuclear energy, Japan's economy will sink under the weight of expensive oil and gas imports. The idea that they're starting up two 30-year-old reactors, what do you make of that?
Well, Japan doesn't have the energy options that other countries do. You know, Germany announced after Fukushima that they were going to phase out nuclear power, but Germany has some options that Japan doesn't have. So they have a huge investment in nuclear power. They rely on nuclear power to a pretty heavy extent. But at the same time, as you pointed out, nuclear power hasn't generated many watts in Japan for the past 4 years, so they have been getting by without it. So it's a, you know, there's a good case to be made that they need it, and there also is an argument to be made that they can phase it out and get by on what they've been getting by on.
But in terms of, I take it these are the same light water reactors that melted down at Fukushima, are they, the Sendai plant?
Well, they're similar, and also to be fair to Fukushima, any reactor type that's operating today anywhere in the world faced with that kind of challenge would have had the same outcome. So that wasn't necessarily a fault of the reactor design,
right,
as it was of the international community to hedge their bets and come up wrong.
Well, no, what I wanted to ask you there was 30 years on one of these plants, where does that put them in terms of their projected
lifetime? The design lifetime is 40 years. More than three-quarters of the plants here in the United States have sought and obtained 20-year extensions to those original 40-year lifetimes. So there's nothing really magic about the 40-year or 30-year lifetime. If you maintain the plant pretty well, you should be able to sustain safety margins. If you don't, you can get in trouble in less than 30 years. So it's really how well you maintain the plant that dictates safety margin more so than the calendar.
So what's been going on in Japan since March of 2011 with these nuclear plants? Not that we know what's been going on at Fukushima. It's apparently still a really difficult containment job, isn't it? I mean,
they have a huge mess to clean up, and it's going to take them literally decades and lots of money to get it behind them. The rest of the plants in Japan have been trying to take the lessons learned from Fukushima, which is that even though you're next to the Pacific Ocean, if you don't have electrical power, workers aren't going to be able to cool the reactor cores. So the other plants in Japan have been installing additional reliable electrical systems, as well as some water pumps and so on, so that there's a greater likelihood that if they're faced with a similar challenge, that their workers will be able to intervene and prevent such a disastrous outcome.
So what are the technical issues involved with restarting a nuclear power plant that's been idle since March of 2011?
Well, one of the challenges is some of the systems are basically idle or performing at very low power, very low pressures. So that as workers start up the reactor, systems that have basically been in standby for 4 years will all of a sudden be operating at higher temperatures, higher pressures. And despite all the tests and inspections they've done, it's likely that they'll uncover a gasket that leaks or a valve packing that leaks water or some other problem that they can't really find when the plant is shut down. It's kind of like, you know, you can take your car into the shop and the mechanic can do all the testing and inspections he wants, but when you take the car out on the road, you hear a rattle or you see the brakes are a little grabby or something that it's hard to test in a shop.
So what does this say then about the politics inside Japan, pro and anti-nuclear? Obviously, the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is, I don't know whether he's pro-nuclear, but he's certainly one of the plants started up again, and he cited the reasons being the importation of oil and gas. But you made the point that they've been operating since 2011 with these alternative sources. So what's the calculus here? I mean, oil, of course, is at a pretty much an all-time low, or not an all-time low, but in the recent years, the Saudis are certainly dumping oil at the lowest prices they can in order to basically drive the fracking movement out of the market. So how would you rate the logic of what the Prime Minister is saying?
Well, it's difficult to understand exactly because Japan doesn't have much natural uranium either for the nuclear power plants. So it's whether you import oil and gas or import uranium for the nuclear power plants. Fukushima was an American reactor design. So they were importing their energy technologies. So that's an interesting argument, but it seems like it's more for debate than for reality. The reality is the power companies in Japan that own the nuclear power plants are very powerful. They have a lot of leverage, not unlike the situation here in the United States. So that those companies don't want to see a huge investment written off and become a huge liability. So they were instrumental in playing the political game in Japan and getting the prime minister to okay the restart of the reactors. It's not whether it's right or wrong. It's just those companies have some political leverage and they used it.
Again, I'm speaking with David Lochbaum, one of the nation's top independent experts on nuclear power. He formerly worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and now serves as director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And we're talking about how the first of Japan's nuclear plants that have been shut down since March 2011's Fukushima disaster. Japan has 25 reactors at 15 plants, and I believe two of them have just started up today. So what then does it say about the Japan's anti-nuclear movement? I mean, it's been obviously a very powerful anti-nuclear movement in terms of nuclear weapons, and we just observed the 70th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What does it say about that movement if the plants were reopened? I believe there wasn't much of a demonstration at the Sendai plant.
It wasn't now. There have been fairly large demonstrations in Japan in the previous years. And where that translated into leverage was the plant owners had to spend more money to show that the plants were safer and had more reliability and were less vulnerable to a Fukushima-like challenge, which drove the costs up. And it's really the economics that dictates nuclear power's future more so than a popularity poll of pro or anti-nuclear folks. But to be fair to the Japanese anti-nuclear community, in the United States, we melted a reactor down at Three Mile Island and still operate nuclear power plants. Russia had the world's worst accident prior to Fukushima, Chernobyl, and continues to operate reactors. So its meltdowns haven't been much leverage for use by those who like to see an end.
So in terms of what's happened here in the United States, since there's a number of, I don't know what the percentage are, but I think a great number of our nuclear power plants are pretty much the same design, are they not, as the Fukushima plants?
Roughly a third of our reactors are very similar.
Right, a third of them. And hasn't there been some, for the first time in the longest time, in decades, with no investment in nuclear power in the United States, suddenly there's a couple of licenses been given?
Yes, there have been four new reactors that the NRC licensed for build and are currently under construction, two in Georgia and two in South Carolina. There's a fifth reactor that was started construction in the 70s, was suspended for a while, and now its owner is about to finish it. It's in here in Tennessee. So we have five reactors under construction, which will pretty much match the five that shut down in the last 2 years due to economics.
Well, but the one at San Onofre, was that economics or the result of protests?
There's really due to economics. The plant was aging. The owner bought two new replacement steam generators at about $700 million, and the replacements broke in less than a year. So they didn't have enough money to go back and buy replacement steam generators. Same with Crystal River in Florida. They were replacing their steam generators, and along the way they broke their containment, which would have cost more than $1 billion to fix. So those plants were still viable had the owners wanted to pony up the millions of dollars it would have taken to fix their problems.
But there are efforts underway, I understand, to shut down Diablo Canyon north of where we are here in Los Angeles.
That's correct. There are a lot of people who are concerned about the safety there. Fukushima was caused primarily by an earthquake and the tsunami. It spawned Diablo Canyon's probably in the highest risk earthquake area in the United States.
And it's right on the ocean.
It's right on the ocean. It's more elevated than Fukushima was by quite a bit, so I'm not so sure the tsunami's the threat in the 1-2 punch. Diablo Canyon's known not to meet the NRC's fire protection regulations, so my bigger concern is an earthquake which could start a fire, and the fact that it doesn't meet fire protection regulations could have play the role that the tsunami played in Fukushima.
Well, one of the things that seems extraordinary is with these nuclear meltdowns, I think Chernobyl was largely started by a rather sort of boneheaded experiment, wasn't it, that they were sort of playing around with it?
Well, they actually were running a safety test to try to make the plant safer in case they lost power.
Right.
But the people who designed the test then handed it over to somebody else to run it on midnight shift on like a Friday night. Mm-hmm. And when deviations came from the plan, the people running the test didn't really understand some of the consequences, and they went horribly awry.
Well, but that was the point I wanted to make, is that that seems to be what's consistent, is the backup power is so important to provide the pumps to keep circulating with the light water reactors, et cetera. So you say that in Japan they've made some improvements to that, they have some backup because the tsunami clearly took out the diesel generators, which weren't elevated, you know. I think that's what people don't understand, is that nuclear power plants, even though they generate electricity, they depend upon a separate and independent source of electricity in cases of loss of power.
That's right. Some of the things that some of the Japanese reactors have done is to put in tanks, like those elevated tanks on stilts, so that gravity can help get the water from that location into the reactor core to cooling. So you minimize your dependence on pumps to take water from the nearby lake, river, or ocean to get it into the reactor core. They've also put in more portable pumps and portable generators, things that we did in this country after 9/11 to make our plants less vulnerable to suicide aircraft. The Japanese knew about 9/11, but hadn't embraced it or hadn't incorporated as many features as we did. Just like they're doing more post-Fukushima than we are, even though we all read the same news and watch the same videos.
But what is then the role of the boron rods that's dropped down to shut the core down? I mean, clearly, it doesn't happen fast enough.
Well, actually, in Fukushima, the earthquake itself triggered the automatic insertion of those control rods within seconds. And the problem is, even with the reactor turned off, as it was at Fukushima, it continues to generate very large amounts of heat. For example, the Fukushima reactors, a few minutes after they're shut down, the reactor cores still produce about 7% as much heat as they did when they're at full power. So if you don't still have pumps that are running to remove that heat, they can overheat and melt, as Fukushima demonstrated once again.
And they're still incredibly hot today, aren't they?
They're cooler. There's more margin. But again, if you lose cooling for a prolonged period of time, you're going to reprise that disaster.
Well, but I've seen footage. I'm not sure whether it was 60 Minutes. They did a piece on these huge tanks that they're building. And just to keep, you know, all the water that pours in, they also, at the time of the disaster, they poured in a lot of seawater. I don't know whatever happened to that stuff, but that's the point being that the water that you pour over the core to cool it, particularly in an emergency, that becomes incredibly contaminated, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. They have about tanks to hold about 80 million gallons of contaminated water. Part of their problem is they have 400 tons per day of water that's flowing down the mountainside towards the ocean, and the contaminated plant is in between those two. So as that groundwater enters the plant, leaks in through cracks or created by the earthquake and whatnot, it becomes contaminated and adds to a very large and growing problem.
And who's paying for this massive problem that Fukushima and the earthquake and the tsunami triggered?
The company got a bailout from the Japanese government to help it pay for all those costs. I actually think they turned a profit last year once you count in the bailout, which I'm not saying that people look at nuclear disasters as a ticket to profits, but if that company can turn a profit, it's some creative accounting.
Well, you're talking about TEPCO, which, you know, was clearly did not, they spread all kinds of disinformation. I think they behaved rather irresponsibly, didn't they? It could have been much less of a disaster had they been more straightforward. That's my understanding.
I think they were, one of the traits of nuclear disasters like Three Mile and Chernobyl and Fukushima is the owners and the regulators just can't believe things are as bad as they are. They're optimistic as all get out. I think TEPCO was very optimistic. I don't think they really recognized things were as bad as they were. And they, anytime they were given a crossroads between things are really bad and things are okay, annoying, but okay, they chose the latter.
And is that a cultural thing, that the guys down the chain just simply don't want to deliver bad news to the people at the top?
It's part of it. It's more like a brainwashing cult type of thing. We just can't believe things are that bad. I worked in the industry for 17 years, and it was amazing. When you do emergency drills, you get to a crossroads, you always pick the worst path because you know all these folks aren't here for the emergency drill for things to go away. But during real life, when you get to that same decision point, you always go towards the path that's the better of the two choices. And it, you know, I think I was objective and unbiased and all that stuff, but I find myself doing the same thing. It's just the way the industry is, both here, Japan, Germany, and elsewhere.
So do you see nuclear power being revived here, given that there have been, as we talked earlier about a number of new plants, two in South Carolina and two reactors in South Carolina. Are there two plants or two reactors?
There's two reactors in both South Carolina
and Georgia.
Georgia.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And is Wall Street has basically not been enthusiastic about nuclear power now for decades. Is there any change of heart in that regard? I know the big argument about the war on coal is so largely hyperbole and misplaced because the marketplace is taking care of coal. People are, power plants are switching to natural gas as quickly as they can. So where do the market forces stand with in terms of nuclear power here in the United States?
Well, I think absent some big change in the economic, like a tax on carbon that would favor nuclear power over coal and natural gas-fired plants, I think nuclear power is just too expensive to compete with other things. The plants that are being built are in states that have, they're guaranteed a rate of return as long as they can show the public service commissions their prudent expenditures. Many states in the United States electricity is a free marketplace. And in those environments, we're seeing the Kewaunee plant in Wisconsin, the Vermont Yankee plant in Vermont shut down because natural gas is just beating them at the meter.
Well, I thank you very much for filling us in on what's happening in Japan and also what's happening here in the United States, David Lockbaum.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with David Lockbaum, one of the nation's top independent experts on nuclear power. He formerly worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and now serves as director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.